right here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, when the coronavirus first appeared in Wuhan, China, North Korea closed its borders faster than almost any other country. The secretive nation's weak healthcare system would face major problems dealing with a large disease outbreak. But nearly 2 years later, North Korea still appears to have few tools other than lockdowns to fight the coronavirus pandemic. North Korea has refused offers of COVID-19 vaccines from other countries. It has also rejected the United Nations-supported COVAX vaccine supply program. The World Health Organization says North Korea is one of only two countries that has not yet started vaccination campaigns. The other is Eritrea. Instead, North Korea has continued border closures and enforced severe travel restrictions within the country. Some observers question North Korea's claims that it has completely kept the coronavirus out of the country. But experts do admit that the early lockdown orders likely prevented pandemic deaths. It works, let's face it. North Korea is able to seal its borders very tightly and control movement. And we know these viruses cannot infect others when they can't move, says Ki Park. He is a North Korea expert at the Massachusetts-based Harvard Medical School. But as North Korea enters year 3 of its lockdown, signs of economic problems are developing. Basic food supplies are now too costly for poorer people in the country. Outside humanitarian aid, an important part of North Korea's economy has been reduced. The economy has taken a major hit, says Lee Song-young. He is chief editor of the Daily NK, a publication based in Seoul, South Korea. Ordinary people now eat only 2 meals per day instead of 3. And the ratio of rice to corn they consume is 3-7 instead of 7-3. It's clear the economic situation is getting worse, Lee said. Many experts say the situation cannot continue for much longer. We are not sure how long they can continue and endure these kinds of difficulties, said Park Won-gong, a professor at Seoul's Ewha University. He added, many people, especially so-called experts on the North Korean economy, are saying next year, probably in the first half, will be the deadline. There are signs that North Korea is trying to open its border to trade with China, its main economic partner. Satellite photos show North Korea is building several centers to improve safety measures in its import operations. Ki Park says any wider opening with China may be tricky, since both countries are using a zero-COVID approach. North Korea has expressed worry about the effectiveness and side effects of the AstraZeneca vaccine that COVAX has provided. It is also concerned about foreign aid workers who would be necessary to carry out a vaccine campaign. North Korea could attempt to get COVID-19 treatment pills instead of vaccines. Some observers say the pills could be especially useful in countries that do not have enough vaccines. But in a pandemic likely seen as a threat to the rule of Kim Jong-un, the leader may instead feel the need to show more control. And that means the lockdown may continue.
Plastic waste in the world's oceans is affecting marine life in new and unusual ways, researchers reported recently. A group of U.S. and Canadian scientists found that some species are living on a huge area of plastic garbage floating in the Pacific Ocean. The team discovered animals such as oceanic barnacles and crabs living alongside coastal barnacles and anemones. Lindsay Harem of the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center was the lead writer of the report that appeared recently in the publication Nature Communications. We expected to find oceanic marine species that have adapted on plastics, but we were surprised to discover coastal marine species as well, Harem said. It is not known how some coastal marine life got out into the ocean, added Harem. They may already be out there settling on the plastics, but most likely they are being transported from the coast on floating debris, she told VOA. Debris is another term for waste. The study looked at the Great Pacific Garbage Patch between Hawaii and California. The patch, or area, is more than 1.5 million square kilometers. It is mostly plastic waste. The debris includes large amounts of very small pieces of plastic, along with water bottles, toothbrushes, and fishing gear. The garbage is drawn together in circular ocean flows called gyres. The plastics can float together like that for years. Amy Uren is chief scientist of the Marine Debris Program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Washington. The size of the patch can change depending on the wind and ocean currents, Uren told VOA. The Ocean Voyages Institute in Sausalito, California, is a nonprofit group that works to remove garbage from the ocean. It gave the researchers the debris needed for the study. Ocean Voyages President Mary Crowley said a large ship with special equipment pulls tons of garbage from the patch. She said the effort seeks especially to remove the very harmful elements like plastic fishing nets that still catch and kill whales, dolphins, and turtles. The researchers were surprised by what they found. What has been most eye-opening is that the coastal marine species were not only thriving, but reproducing, Harem said. However, many questions are still unanswered. How do you survive being on a piece of plastic in the middle of the ocean? Asks Greg Ruiz of the Smithsonian's Environmental Research Center and a writer of the report. The coastal species may be creating their own ecosystem on the plastic debris, Ruiz said. Fish and bird waste in the water may provide food. We also want to figure out how the coastal and oceanic species are interacting, since they are competing for limited space on the objects, Harem said. They could be using each other as a source of food. There is also some concern that some of the creatures may become invasive species. We want to know if other coastal marine life are on plastics in all of the 5 main ocean gyres worldwide, Harem said. Ruiz added, "We are concerned that coastal organisms from different regions could form colonies and spread disease to other marine life, including fish." I'm John Russell.
As schools open after the holiday vacation, school officials must again decide whether to keep students away. The Omicron version of the coronavirus is spreading quickly. Cases in the United States have doubled in a short period. In December, President Joe Biden announced renewed efforts to get more Americans vaccinated and to get booster shots. In addition, he announced expanded COVID-19 testing, partly paid for by the government. However, he also urged schools to remain open. Biden said more vaccines are available to children and there is federal support for schools. Last year, we thought the only way to keep children safe was to close their schools, Biden said. Today, we know more, and we have the tools to keep schools open. But schools are still closing. Burbio is a company that tracks school closures in the U.S. As of Monday afternoon, it found 2,753 schools that have closed or changed to in-person classes this week. When the Delta variant was spreading in late August, 792 schools closed to in-person classes. Monday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the Pfizer booster shot for children as young as 12. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, said 13.5 million 12 to 17-year-olds have received two Pfizer shots. That is just over half of children in that age group. Hospitalizations among children who have been vaccinated at lower rates are also rising. But early research suggests that Omicron is a less severe version of the disease. A third shot of vaccine, the booster shot, also appears to be effective at fighting off the new version of the coronavirus. In late December, the CDC changed its guidelines about quarantining if someone is infected with the Omicron variant. Now, those infected with Omicron are requested to stay isolated for 5 days instead of 10, as suggested earlier. Shorter isolation time may make it easier for schools to stay open. Students infected with Omicron would miss just 5 days of class. The CDC and Department of Education Secretary Miguel Cardona support test-to-stay policies for schools. Such a policy calls for students to remain in school after they come in contact with a student with the virus if tests show they are not infected. Some schools have required students to quarantine for several days before returning to class. This is welcome news to principals who are dealing with lengthy and disruptive quarantines, said the National Association of Elementary School Principals in a statement about the CDC guidelines. Even as the pandemic continues to pose new challenges, we must remain laser-focused on ensuring students are attending in-person schooling when it is safe to do so. But some school districts were not prepared for the increase in coronavirus cases. Detroit schools in Michigan are closed this week through Wednesday to test all school workers for the virus. But students will not be attending online classes because some students do not have computers, District Superintendent Nikolai Vidi said in a written statement. Closing schools will give them a chance to have as much of a COVID-free working environment as possible, while possibly preparing students for a laptop distribution process during the end of the week. Chicago is the country's third largest school district. Officials there announced the purchase of 100,000 laptop computers over the holidays in case they are needed for learning at home in January. District leaders said they hope to avoid closing all schools in the area. The Chicago Teachers Union supports temporarily halting in-person learning. It also supports new safety measures like COVID-19 tests showing students are not infected before they can return to school. In Florida's Miami-Dade County, testing has shown that 1 in 4 people have been infected with the coronavirus. The school system announced Thursday that all school workers must wear face coverings at school. Students are strongly encouraged to wear them. A state law prevents school districts from requiring face coverings for students. Cardona wrote in a message to districts that 99% of schools were open in person in December, compared with 46% last January. The goal remains to keep all schools open for in-person learning 5 days a week throughout the 2021-22 school year and beyond, he said. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell the story of that war.
Unlike other presidents of the late 1800s, William McKinley spent much of his presidency dealing with foreign policy. The most serious problem involved Spain. Spain ruled Cuba at that time. Cuban rebels had started a fight for independence. The Spanish government promised the Cuban people equal rights and self-rule, but in the future. The rebels did not want to wait. President McKinley felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises. He also felt responsible for protecting the lives and property of Americans in Cuba. When riots broke out in Havana, he ordered the battleship Maine to sail there. One night in early 1898, a powerful explosion sank the Maine. More than 250 American sailors died. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks, but many Americans blamed Spain. They demanded war to free Cuba and make it independent.
President McKinley had a difficult decision to make. He did not want war. As he told a friend, "I fought in our Civil War. I saw the dead piled up. I do not want to see that again." But McKinley also knew many Americans wanted war. If he refused to fight Spain, his Republican Party could lose popular support. So, he did not ask Congress for a declaration of war right away. He sent a message to the Spanish government instead. McKinley demanded an immediate ceasefire in Cuba. He also offered his help in ending the revolt. By the time Spain agreed to the demands, McKinley had made his decision. He asked Congress for permission to use military force to bring peace to Cuba. Congress agreed. It also demanded that Spain withdraw from Cuba and give up all claims to the island. The president signed the congressional resolution. The Spanish government immediately broke relations. On April 25th, 1898, the United States declared war on Spain.
The American Navy was ready to fight. It was three times bigger than the Spanish Navy. It also was better trained. A shipbuilding program begun 15 years earlier had made the American Navy one of the strongest in the world. Its ships were made of steel and carried powerful guns. Part of the American Navy at that time was based in Hong Kong. The rest was based on the Atlantic coast of the United States. Admiral George Dewey commanded the Pacific Fleet. Dewey had received a message from the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Theodore Roosevelt. If war broke out, it said, he was to attack the Spanish naval force in the Philippines. The Spanish force was commanded by Admiral Patricio Montojo.
The American fleet arrived in Manila Bay on May 1st. It sailed toward the line of Spanish ships. The Spanish fired first. The shells missed. When the two naval forces were 5,000 meters apart, Admiral Dewey ordered the Americans to fire. After 3 hours, Admiral Montojo surrendered. Most of his ships were sunk. 400 of his men were dead or wounded. American land forces arrived several weeks later. They captured Manila, giving the United States control of the Philippines.
Dewey was suddenly a hero. Songs and poems were written about him. Congress gave him special honors. A spirit of victory spread across the nation. People called for an immediate invasion of Cuba. Unlike the Navy, America's army was not ready to fight. When war was declared, the army had only about 25,000 men. Within a few months, however, it had more than 200,000. The soldiers trained at camps in the southern United States. One of the largest camps was in Florida. Cuba is just 150 kilometers off the coast of Florida.
2 weeks after the Spanish-American War began, the Army sent a small force to Cuba. The force was ordered to inspect the north coast of Cuba and to take supplies to Cuban rebels. That invasion failed, but the second one succeeded. 400 American soldiers landed with guns, bullets, and supplies for the rebels. Next, the Army planned to send 25,000 men to Cuba. Their goal was the port of Santiago on the south coast. American ships had trapped a Spanish naval force there earlier. One of the commanders of the big American invasion force was Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt had resigned as Assistant Secretary of the Navy when the war started. He organized a group of horse soldiers. Most of the men were cowboys from America's Southwest. They could ride and shoot well. Some were rich young men from New York who simply shared Roosevelt's love of excitement. The group became known as Roosevelt's Rough Riders.
As the Americans landed near Santiago, Spanish forces withdrew to positions outside the city. The strongest force was at San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers used smokeless gunpowder. This made their artillery hard to find. The Americans did not have the smokeless powder, but they had Gatling machine guns, which poured a stream of bullets at the enemy. When the machine guns opened fire, American soldiers began moving up San Juan Hill. Several American reporters watched. Later, one of them wrote this report. "I have seen many pictures of the charge on San Juan Hill, but none seem to show it as I remember it. In the pictures, the men are running up the hill quickly in straight lines. There seem to be so many men that no enemy could stand against them." "In fact," said the reporter, "there were not many men, and they moved up the hill slowly, in a close group, not in a straight line. It seemed as if someone had made a terrible mistake. One wanted to call to these few soldiers to come back."
The American soldiers were not called back. They reached the top of San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers fled. "All we have to do," an American officer said, "is hold on to the hill, and Santiago will be ours." American Commander General William Shafter sent a message to Spanish Commander General José Toral. Shafter demanded Toral's surrender. While he waited for an answer, the Spanish naval force tried to break out of Santiago Harbor. The attempt failed, and the Americans took control of the port. The loss destroyed any hope that Spain could win the war. There was now no way it could send more soldiers and supplies to Cuba. General Toral agreed to a short ceasefire so women and children could leave Santiago. But he rejected General Shafter's demand of unconditional surrender. American artillery then attacked Santiago. General Toral defended the city as best he could. Finally, on July 17th, he surrendered. The United States promised to send all his soldiers back to Spain.
In the next few weeks, American forces occupied Puerto Rico and the Philippine capital of Manila. America's war with Spain was over. It had lasted just 10 weeks. The next step was to negotiate terms of a peace treaty. The negotiations would be held in Paris. The victorious United States demanded independence for Cuba. It demanded control over Puerto Rico and Guam, and it demanded the right to occupy Manila. The two sides agreed quickly on the terms concerning Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam, but they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. Spain rejected the American demand for control. It did not want to give up this important colony. Negotiations on this point of the peace treaty lasted for days.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.